Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, November 9th, and President Obama has an unexpected vacancy at the CIA. And I thought spies were supposed to be able to manage a double life.
Oh, don't get caught, yeah. Meeting in the park, but always after dark, slipping and sliding around on the back streets of town.
Lee Schott Williams is the artist who opens our News and Information with Commentary podcast today. And it was a surprise to hear that the top spook at the CIA, David Petraeus, the general who got so many plaudits for the surge in Iraq and the surge in Afghanistan, and then he surged on over to the CIA, where he got to direct the drone strikes and manage the secret war of the United States, or that should be wars. And I can't explain why this would develop in the way it has. Apparently, he notified the White House yesterday of his intention to resign. The president agonized over it overnight. Then he held not a press conference, but he gave a little talk at the White House that we'll discuss in a moment. And it was after that that the information was released that Petraeus would be stepping down at the CIA. And it is unusual in a letter of resignation to mention that, oh, yes, I'm doing this because I had an affair and such behavior is unacceptable, both as a husband and as the leader of an organization such as ours. And usually they say, well, I want to spend more time with my mistress. Oh, well. To me, this is actually a good development. I don't wish Petraeus ill, and I'm not interested in his private life. But this administration sorely needs new thinking and new blood in the national security team. And somebody who's not committed to staying in Afghanistan forever and ever because he had a personal stake in the outcome, like Petraeus did. And with the hopeful expiration of the extra innings of Robert Mueller at the FBI in July of this year, maybe there will be some outsiders with new thinking, new ideas, new perspectives brought in for the second term of the Obama administration. Oh, there I go, daydreaming again. Well, he held a little set of remarks. I wanted to call it a press conference, but I don't think any questions were allowed. And the president had a posse of supporters there to applaud him as he basically issued a statement regarding the lame duck session of Congress. And he did take my advice, not that I expect he's been listening to me, and declared that he does have a mandate to raise taxes on the ultra-rich, to allow those Bush tax cuts to expire. And while he offered some flexibility, he did take a pretty firm stand that any resolution to the long-term deficit and the ongoing annual budget deficits has to include some new revenue. John Boehner says, well, maybe some new revenue from closing tax loopholes and from growing the economy. No, that's not going to work. Those are empty promises. Those are hypotheticals. And it's interesting because Paul Krugman, in his Friday New York Times column, articulated what many people, particularly Democrats, appear to be thinking in Washington. Let's stare these mofos down. I'm referring to the recalcitrant Republicans. Basically give them a choice. They can make a deal in the lame duck session where some of the Tea Party freshmen will have their last stand before they're ejected from the House. Or they can try to make a deal with the new Congress in January after letting all tax cuts expire, including for you and me. And the other issue on the bargaining table is the extension of the payroll tax cut. And I've never been in favor of this payroll tax cut because it represents a raid on the Social Security Trust Fund. And I know that they claim to have backfilled that from other sources. They say it's paid for. But I just think that it's a really bad way to try to stimulate the economy. It was a desperate move on Obama's part 2 years ago when he blinked on allowing those Bush tax cuts for the wealthy to expire then. And inexplicably, they allowed that merry-go-round to return during this election cycle and without knowing the composition of the incoming Congress. So we'll see, but Krugman makes some good points. He says, I don't mean to minimize the very real economic dangers posed by the so-called fiscal cliff. But he says that we cannot allow hostage-taking and economic blackmail to continue. And that I certainly agree with. And all of these things can be finessed, including the threatened sequestration, the automatic cuts 10% across the board that would include defense and domestic spending, by simply postponing the day of reckoning, or by cutting some sort of a deal. Is John Boehner able to deliver members of his caucus in a deal like that? Remains to be seen. Next to the Krugman column in Friday's New York Times, an interesting op-ed by Eric L. Lewis, who is described only as a partner at the law firm Lewis Ba'ak. And I don't know Mr. Lewis. And he's a little more moderate than I am on these issues of human rights and the Constitution. But he makes four really important points. One, that Obama must release Guantanamo detainees, at least 86 of whom have been cleared for release because they pose no threat to America. And this would be an important step forward to eventually closing Guantanamo. And Mr. Lewis goes on to another step that could facilitate that. He says the U.S. should try the remaining Guantanamo detainees in civilian courts. That I fully support. And that's what Attorney General Eric Holder said he was going to do, and then, after a chorus of boos, he buckled. Third, says Lewis, the United States should end indefinite detention without trial. Hooray for you, sir. There is no basis to just hold people forever and refuse to charge them. And if we can't convict them because the evidence against them was derived from torture, so be it. Get it over with. Guantanamo is an icon of the injustice that many people view from the United States, particularly since 9/11. And unless we adhere to our own call for the rule of law and allow these cases to go forward, and remember, we brought you the interview with the former prosecutor at Guantanamo who quit. His name is Morris Davis, Colonel Morris Davis. He quit after his superior said, there can't be any acquittals here. This is a kangaroo court, remember that. Well, we need to show that there are real courts. And we should release those whom we're not going to charge. We should only charge those whom we believe we can convict. And then we've got to do it on the up and up. And if they're convicted, so be it. I can live with that. That's due process. That's some form of justice. Badly delayed, but still some form of justice. But to allow them to linger in limbo and die off through suicide, disease, and perhaps old age, although most of these individuals are fairly young still, is unconscionable and, I think, fundamentally un-American. And the final point from Mr. Lewis here, Obama must bring drones under the rule of law. Well, how about that? That's right here in my New York Times. It's unacceptable, he says, that the decisions that the president makes in the Tuesday killer capture video call are made without public accountability or oversight, and that American citizens like the Yemeni-American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki have been deprived of their lives without being afforded due process. I fully agree with that. And it's rare to see this expressed in mainstream corporate media. Also at Guantanamo, our friend Jason Leopold continues to follow the case of the mysterious death of Adnan Latif, a Yemeni, age 36, who died this past September. Based on what we've been told, he did not end his own life. There was no evidence that he took his life, you know, like by a jail cell hanging or some other self-induced end of life. And his autopsy has finally been completed, and as soon as today is expected to be turned over to the Embassy of Yemen in Washington, D.C. And Leopold reached the brother of Adnan Latif, Mohammed, and he said that after the family has seen the autopsy, they will release it to the public. And Leopold quotes Mohammed, saying, "When will America apply the principles it claims to uphold? When will the American people demand the U.S. government uphold the law? American is playing politics with a dead person. America doesn't care about our rights, my brother's rights, or human rights. Yet America claims they are favoring human rights all over the world. It's hypocrisy." That's extremely powerful. And I think it's in sync with the Lewis op-ed that I just read you excerpts of from the New York Times today. The U.S. Supreme Court announced today that it has agreed to review a case related to the Voting Rights Act from the 1960s, and it's very unclear whether this will be an extension of the monitoring of voting processes in certain areas where discrimination was known to occur in the past, or if they will declare that America is a race-free nation. There's no racism, nothing to worry about. We have full equality for African Americans, and we're just going to discard these relics of the past attempting to address the long-term discrimination against African Americans. And while this is anecdotal and is unlikely to be presented to the U.S. Supreme Court, there is a map that I'm looking at online that a group of geography academics called Floating Sheep created, and it is based on Twitter comments, on tweets, that included racist remarks, including the N-word and calling President Obama a monkey. And it's fascinating to look at a map of the United States with these little red dots that show where certain numbers of racist tweets originated. And I, for one, don't want Twitter to censor people's expression. I think you have the First Amendment right to tweet and tweet a racist comment if that's what you want to do. And I want to be fair that as I look at the map, the states that have zero tweets are Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, South Dakota, and, oh, there's only one in Oregon. It looks like virtually every other state, well, Vermont appears to be excluded here, but just about every state has some racists, including some from my backyard here in the San Francisco Bay Area and the Sacramento area. But the preponderance of racist expression on Twitter is in Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. Have we gone beyond racism? Have we reached the point where the Supreme Court can say we don't need the Voting Rights Act? I think not. I want to commend to you an article you can find at thenation.com. Ari Berman, who has been a guest on our program many times in the past, wrote a piece about how the Republican war on voting appears to have backfired. And if you recall, while I didn't go full Dick Morris and predict that Obama would lose because of the voter suppression, voter intimidation tactics, I raised very serious and repeated concerns about this, and I don't think I was wrong. I think that there were these tactics, they just were not as effective because we got the word out, and certain communities reacted by saying, well, damn, you're not going to steal my vote. And so, the overall share of the black electorate increased from 11 to 15%. And it was at an all-time high in 2008. But this year, up to 15%. That's good news. The same thing happened with the Latino vote, which increased slightly from 9% to 10% and broke even stronger for Obama. The ratio in 08 was 67-31. This year, it was 71-27. And Berman writes that he was in Cleveland at black churches on the Sunday before the election, and he quotes a Reverend Tony Miner saying, "When they went after Big Mama's voting rights, they made all of us mad." He said, this is a quote from CBS News, "More African Americans voted in Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida than in 2008. So when you couple that with the failure of the big money lie machines funded by the Koch brothers, managed by Karl Rove and the Chamber of Commerce and Americans for Prosperity, it does appear that certain American voter segments understand when they are being used, when they are being victimized, and they respond in the ways available to them. In today's, the Friday edition of the New York Times, buried back by the obituaries, is an article by someone named Ariel Kaminer that ridicules Mark Crispin Miller, calling him a lonely voice of doom for raising serious questions about the accuracy and credibility of voting on electronic machines. Mark Crispin Miller is a guy I have a high regard for. I've interviewed him many times. He wrote the book Fooled Again. He operates a nearly daily internet listserv that brings me a lot of valuable information, and I regard him as highly credible. But this is like the way the New York Times has occasionally covered the 9/11 truth movement, only for the purpose of ridiculing it. So they trot out the serious comments of Professor Miller, he teaches at NYU, and then they ridicule him. It's a kind of lynching by newsprint. So it cites his books, and then it says the book was all but ignored by the news media. Miller says that's because America cannot handle the truth. I think he's right. Then the article goes on. Critics on the right and even the left have dismissed Professor Miller as a conspiracy theorist. Then they quote him. "I have colleagues who assume that I was yodeling in the blue distance of absolute crackpot speculation," he said. Well, I think that this is a really snarky piece of reporting. I can't call it journalism. And I haven't seen Miller comment on it in his email streams. But if you have a chance, you can find this at the New York Times. And all I can say is that even though this election turned out generally in favor of the left, and I'm not talking about me and the far left, but I'm talking about Democrats, they will once again hit the snooze button and put off any issues related to voting matters, except maybe the long lines that occurred in Florida, Ohio, and elsewhere. But fundamental changes in our broken election system are unlikely to occur because the people who have to preside over that are the very people who won this election, and the system's working for them. And if a few people in Florida had to wait in a long line, that means that there are 48, 49 other states that say, I don't see a problem out there. And as we wrap up this long election week and get ready for a little break and maybe some diversion this weekend, I just got an email from Will Durst. And he wants to take 2 minutes of your time to recap the top 10 females who cost Mitt Romney the election. Take it away, Will Durst.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here to say, holy moly, thank God that's over.
After what seemed like a couple of decades, Barack Obama managed to eke out a victory, or to be more precise, Mitt Romney found a way to lose. He actually found many ways, and each of them can be traced directly to women. Young women, old women, single women, married women, duchesses, and floozies. So here they are, 10 women, each of whom represent one of the many factors that cost Mitt Romney the presidency. Newly elected U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, where the former governor lost by 23 points, proving that the man arouses the passion of a broken garden rake. Michelle Bachmann. Mitt had a draft on her right wing to win the primary battle, and when he tried to tack back to the center, looked like a man with the core values of a hollow chocolate Easter bunny with good hair. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who took foreign policy off the table, making the whole election about the economy, which kept getting better, gall darn it. Sandra Fluke, who gave a face to the GOP's Paleolithic Bronze Age attitudes about females, which no man in the party could seemingly shut up about. Michelle Obama, who is just darn likable, as is her husband, in a stark contrast to Romney's obvious discomfort around members of the human species. Superstorm Sandy, for providing the opportunity for Chris Christie and Barack Obama to French kiss on Atlantic City's boardwalk, proving that bipartisanship is more than just a word. Ann Romney, who would have made a great first lady for Dwight D. Eisenhower. Candy Crowley, who stopped Romney's momentum in the second debate by speaking way above her pay grade. Don't you hate it when the help speaks out of turn? The Walmart moms, who never really understood the whole Cayman Islands bank account thing, marking him as not the poster child for the 1%, but the poster child for the 0.0001% of the 1%. And the final female responsible for Romney's loss, Rafalka, the 15-year-old mare who wore the Romney silks in Olympic dressage. Seriously, Mitt, dressage? For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thank you, Will, and thank you, too, with the earbuds or the computer speakers. I appreciate you joining me today. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.